Welcome to Triple Take, the podcast where we talk to interesting people about the book, album, and film that shaped them. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm John Hammontree.
And I'm Matt Scalise.
All right, our guest today is Andrea Taylor, the president and CEO of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. Now, I know we're just a little past your one-year anniversary here in Birmingham. You came here previously from Microsoft and the Pacific Northwest, is that right?
And New York City.
So tell us a little bit about what your transition to Birmingham has been like.
Well, the transition to Birmingham has actually been fabulous, and I really appreciate that question. I continue to be asked a year in about why I came and how I feel about being here. And I came because I had visited the Institute only once prior to being approached about the position. I was very impressed and intrigued with the region generally. I was here on the Civil Rights Pilgrimage with Congressman John Lewis and Congressman Steny Hoyer. And I hadn't heard of and been to the Institute. And when I came, I was really just quite taken aback and very moved and enthusiastic about the presentation at the Civil Rights Institute and the surrounding Civil Rights District. So when I was approached about possibly being interested in this position, I knew a little about it based on an hour and a half visit. And I thought, what an intriguing opportunity to come into the region to work with such an important institution in a community and at a time when much of the race and community dialogue, societal impact, still is so relevant and so germane, even though the Institute deals with issues that happened more than 50 years ago. We're still in a conversation and evolving in this nation in terms of race and how we create and maintain and foster community. And so to be in this place at this time feels like a very privileged opportunity, and hopefully I can make a difference while I'm here in terms of helping the Institute to move into its second 25 years of history.
The Institute is my favorite museum in Birmingham, and every time I go to it, as you said, I'm reminded of how relevant the issues that were happening 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago are today. And I'm interested in what it was like to take over the Institute in a period where so much of the past has come back and is dominating the conversation today. Do you feel any sense of obligation to take a more active role in the community rather than a historical role?
Well, I think it's a combination, really, of history and education. We are we're an educational institution. We don't have a point of view. We really exist to provide information and education and awareness about the issues, and we leave it to others to be the organizers and the marchers and the demonstrators. But it's really important in our time for people of all ages and from all walks of life to understand the history that brought us to this moment. And much of what we're seeing in our communities across the country is not happening in a vacuum. There is a long historical pattern of behavior and activity and interaction or lack of interaction in communities, really harkening all the way back to slavery. And the more that the community and individuals can know about that history and understand their role or not in it, I think it makes it easier for us to come together as a community and try to move forward in a positive and constructive way. So our role is really one of education and awareness and linking the historical facts and realities to the current situation that we find ourselves in, helping to provide context for the current situation, and also providing lessons of how to move forward in a peaceful, nonviolent way, which I think all would agree is the more acceptable way to try and overcome some of the challenges that we see in our communities today.
Certainly. And I know that the Smithsonian just opened a new Museum of African American History and Culture. Have you had a chance to visit, or will you be visiting soon?
I have had a chance to visit. There was really nowhere else that I wanted to be on the planet on Saturday, September 24th, except for Washington, D.C., on the Mall, to be a part of and a witness to the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I had been privileged while I was at Microsoft in 2012 to be at the groundbreaking ceremony, which was hosted by President and Mrs. Obama, and to go to the White House actually for the reception after that opening or that groundbreaking ceremony. And it was just a very exciting time. The site is remarkable. The need to capture the history of a people who have been neglected, really, in the history in a more complete way for a very long time. It was just something that I felt that I really wanted to be a part of. So I was delighted as a charter member of the museum to have gotten an invitation and to have been on the grounds and in the house, as they say, for that opening. It's an experience that I think every American, not just African Americans, but every American should really make a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. if they're able to visit the museum, plan to spend several hours, if not a couple of days, walking through a history that really, as I said, belongs to all of us, and I think will help people to understand more about the communities in which we live, about the diversity that is becoming increasingly characteristic of this nation, and about a way forward and an example of how people who have been oppressed for a very long time, and yet still we rise and still we move forward and we contribute and are engaged in participating in this democracy of ours in very constructive ways. So it's a marvelous facility, and we're thrilled that it's there.
Can you tell us a little bit about upcoming events that'll be held at the Institute?
Well, we have ongoing programs, as you know. We have a community of readers program for young people. We have panel discussions and conversations about race and society and community ongoing. But our really signature event that we're planning for and looking forward to at this vantage point is the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award, which is an annual award that we give to an outstanding leader in human and civil rights in the country or whose work also extends to a global community. And this year, we're very delighted that Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the congressional representative from the District of Columbia and an outstanding legal scholar and professor, will be our honoree, and we're really delighted to have Representative Holmes coming on November the 19th. We'll be celebrating at the Lyric Theater, and we really look forward to that occasion with great enthusiasm.
And people can buy tickets online?
People can buy tickets online. They can go to our website, www.bcri.org, or give us a call at 328-9696.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's dive right into your selections of the film, the book, and the piece of music that have most influenced you. What did you decide on today?
So I decided on three items, two of which are closely related, and one is an outlier, but will give your listeners a different insight into my background and experience. And so the book is a book entitled For the Inward Journey, The Writings of Howard Thurman. It was published in 1984, and Howard Thurman was a distinguished minister, philosopher, theologian, and educator. And the film is somewhat related in terms of its origins and its content, and it's part of a documentary film series called Eyes on the Prize, which was about America's civil rights movement. It was produced in the 1980s by a producer named Henry Hampton, and it's a 14-part series. So today I thought we might talk about one of those 14 hours, which is called No Easy Walk, and it addresses the issues of the marches and the activities in the civil rights movement, primarily here in Birmingham in 1963, as well as the March on Washington and the bombing of the Four Little Girls, which was in the 16th Street Baptist Church, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963. A piece of music, which is the outlier, is Ravel's Bolero, Maurice Ravel's Bolero. Keep your eyes
on the prize. Hold on. So your film selection is, in particular, it's an episode of the PBS documentary series Eyes on the Prize, and the episode you wanted to talk about is called No Easy Walk. And I'll let you walk me through sort of some of the moments featured in this episode, but obviously particularly relevant to the Birmingham civil rights scene, and a lot of the things that take place in this episode are just literally right outside the door of your museum.
That is absolutely true, and again, I was first exposed to the Eyes on the Prize series, the overall series, and the makers of that series back in 1986 or 7, just about the time that they were working on and producing this, and it was being released. And I had the opportunity as a consultant, actually, to the Ford Foundation, that was one of the principal funders of the series, to meet with and talk with the producers and understand what they were trying to do, and also to talk with the Ford Foundation that really took a risk in investing in a program like this. And you might ask yourself, well, why would it be important to make a series like Eyes on the Prize and to capture these stories 20 years out from the events? And it became very clear as I began to talk to the producers and the makers and the funders that there was only part of the story on the record, really, and that before people transitioned and before many of the voices and the activists who were involved in the movement were no longer accessible or you know, were transitioning, they wanted to capture that. And the story that had been told primarily was one of the perspective of national media. So the, you know, the major broadcasters, CBS, ABC, NBC, had done a lot of the documentation from a news perspective of the events that were happening in Birmingham and all over the South and all over the country where civil rights issues were being addressed. But that was the only perspective that was on record. They hadn't really gone out and talked to the ordinary people, the foot soldiers, the people who were just everyday people who were sick and tired of being sick and tired and decided that they wanted to make a change. And this series set out to do that. It set out to tell a more balanced story and to bring the voices and empower the voices of the actual participants in the movement and not just the government and authority figures and the like. And so that was my first introduction to the series, and it really was an amazing journey for me as one of the funders, ultimately, at the Ford Foundation, where I was a program director at the time, to really get behind the scenes of the making of Eyes on the Prize. And the No Easy Walk series deals with mostly 1963 time period, which I think many in your listening audience will know was a pivotal year, a turning point in the civil rights movement. And it includes in that particular episode, that particular 1 hour of the series, it includes the Children's March here in May of 1963, where Bull Connor had dogs and hoses to hold back children, where he arrested 900 girls and took them out to the 4-H field. He arrested another, several hundred young men who were jailed in various places around the city. They used German shepherds and hoses to hold back the crowd who were peacefully demonstrating against segregation under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King. And then, of course, it includes the Freedom Riders and the discussion about what happened in Anniston and the buses that were bombed. And It goes on into the summer season, and everyone was, many from Alabama went to Washington, D.C. to participate in the March on Washington, which was an event that everyone had a great deal of trepidation about in advance. No one knew. There was a call sent out to the communities to everyone should walk, ride, take a train, bus, however they could get to Washington, D.C. They were urged by Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy and others to get to Washington to protest against segregation and the policies that were excluding people from full participation in the American democracy. And everyone was really quite concerned about what might happen with such a demonstration, and no one knew what the response would be. We now, of course, know that 250,000 people showed up. It was a very hot and humid day in Washington, D.C., but all of that notwithstanding, it was one of the most peaceful, almost surreal experiences for everyone, and Dr. King's now famous, infamous really, I Have a Dream speech was made, and it was a major turning point in the movement, and everyone was buoyed by that sense of the possibility and the hope and the optimism. I happen to have been privileged as a high school student to have been at the march that day and was among the 250,000 people who were there. And we knew in that moment that something really historic had occurred and that it was indeed a turning point. So everyone left the march on August 28, 1963 with a sense of real optimism and hope. And then we get to September 15th, 1963, and of course that was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, and four children died in that bombing. Many were injured, and there were two other killings that day involving young black boys, and not unlike some of the experiences that we're seeing in our communities now with respect to deaths and killing of young people, young African Americans and other people of color. So we went from the euphoria of the march to the reality and the brutality of the horrific events at 16th Street Baptist Church, and really a recalibration of the movement for civil rights. So this is the story that is told by this particular episode, No Easy Walk, and the Eyes on the Prize and Blackside Incorporated production crew came to Birmingham to, you know, record these voices to get the story. And interestingly enough, as we prepare for our 25th anniversary at the Institute, at the Civil Rights Institute, in looking at some of the programs and records, in 1992, when the Institute opened officially on November 15th, actually, of that year, many of the program participants were actually producers from Eyes on the Prize, because they had been in the community, they had captured the voices, and they were invited back to tell the story of how that series came about, the impact that it had, and why they wanted to talk to people who were not completely unknown, but in terms of exposure in the mass media, their voices had been muted, if heard at all. And it was just a very interesting juxtaposition. So it's a series that I, as I say, feel very strongly about. It has great power. It had great power when it was released, and it still has great power. And again, having worked behind the scenes with the production crew, one of the things that they were very aware of as they were making this series was how important it was to capture those voices, and that they would also probably be the only team of creative people and producers who would ever be able to raise the multi-millions of dollars sure. that it would require to produce such a series. As I recall, it was at least, you know, $500,000 to $1 million an hour to produce the series and to promote it and to develop educational materials and the like. And so they wanted to be really sure that they got the story right and that they told it in a balanced and productive way. So one of the things that the producer, Henry Hampton, who was really a visionary and a documentary leader in the 20th century, one of the requirements that he put in place in developing this series was that each hour had to have two producers. So they were co-producers who worked together to decide what the narrative would be and how the story would be told. And they had to work out any differences among their own personal understanding of the movement and the story that they were telling. So it would be one producer was white and one was black.
Oh, wow.
And every single one of the 14 hours had that structure. And it was really interesting because depending on who you were in that coupling, you had a different memory and a different
sure.
experience in real time if you were still alive, or even currently, based on who you were and your own perspective. And it was often real tension between these producers for each of these hours. So you got 28 people who were making 14 films who could have radically different views about the history that they were charged with documenting and presenting. And it made for a very interesting role for the executive producer to try and mitigate when there were disagreements.
Sure.
And there were disagreements, not sometimes radical disagreements, but just in terms of interpretation and how you tell the story and from whose vantage point. And so they couldn't close the film and, you know, get to the final cut until they had worked through all of the intellectual and philosophical and practical conversation about that. The good news about that process, which really came to be known as the Black Side Method, is that it forced a very honest conversation and a confrontation about some of the differences of interpretation. And when it was finally screened and broadcast and distributed in classrooms, and I think it probably still stands as one of the seminal works that are used in colleges and universities.
That's where I saw it, in
high school across the country. No one has ever taken issue with any of the editorial content or the point of view, because they fought that out in long sessions,
sure.
far into the night at the Black Side production studios on Shaman Avenue in Roxbury. And it really made for a better series. And I think there's a lesson in that process for today, that we need to make sure, as stories are being told and issues are being discussed, that you include many points of view, not just one, because you only get a part of the story. You really need to have the balance. So when they went to the CBS archives or the ABC archives or NBC, those were the major broadcasters of the time, they didn't find that balance. They found some of it, but not all of it. So they had to come to places like Birmingham and talk to the people who were still here. They were still walking around among us, and they had vivid memories of their experience. And they tried to include in the series both and all. It was a both-and strategy that really gave a much more complete and nuanced picture.
So one thing I want to ask you about, the format that these shows took, obviously having the voices of the people that experienced this was very important. When we look at, you know, the mission of the Civil Rights Institute, really, as somebody who went there as a kid with a, you know, on a school field trip, as many kids in this area do, one of the things that really strikes you about it is the first time you walk in that room, when the screen rises up and you walk into that room that's just filled with artifacts from the time, mm-hmm. and it's putting you in that first person perspective and making you feel like you were there. This is not a historical document. This is not a list of things that happened on a page. This is something people lived through. I mean, that's really seems to be kind of the feel that this documentary is going for. And I think probably with a topic like this, empathy is such an important part of getting that message across. Do you find that's a big strategy behind, I guess, certainly what you guys do there, but also, you know, this series and why it's so effective?
Absolutely. I think empathy is an issue and an area that we struggle with in our society. We're particularly in a media environment. There are so many images and so many stories and so many crises that we're all bombarded with on a daily basis that it's easy to tune out, not deliberately, but there's only so much absorptive capacity that a human being has for tragedy and tension and difficulty. And so you'll often find that the best stories are in a war situation or conflict or any kind of environment. The best way to communicate is to pick one story, one individual, one family, tell that story because you can absorb that. You can imagine, you can empathize and imagine how you might feel if you were in a similar circumstance. And I think that that's the power of a documentary series like Eyes on the Prize. They really, even within a story, they've made choices, hopefully the right ones, about the two or three, four voices that are going to tell bring the story forward. And one of the things that you realize when you're watching on is that there are many more individuals who could have been a part of that
sure.
discussion, but they weren't included because you just can't take it all in. So I think that empathy is an important value in our culture and in our society as you move through conflicting situations and as you think about social change and social transformation. Empathy is not always a foregone conclusion. Sometimes it has to be taught and described and discussed. People can learn, I think, to be more empathetic, but it needs to be a conscious part of the dialogue. And I think Eyes on the Prize and this particular story gives you that sense of empathy. The other thing about this film that is intriguing, it was made, as I said, in the late 80s, and they're talking about events that occurred in the 60s.
Right.
And so you're also given a window, and you're privy to a description that has been sitting for a couple of decades with the storytellers. And there, what you see is their reflection looking back and remembering how they felt and what was motivating them and what was driving them 20 years before. And in some cases, they have evolved and they begin to, on reflection, see that maybe the strategy and the approach that they took in the 60s would not be the one that they would take in the 80s. And so there's something very empowering about that, to know that people can be in one place, but over time and through experiences, they can go somewhere else. And then there are others who were very clear in real time about what they needed to do and how they needed to move forward. And that comes through as well as their continued affirmation that what they did was the right thing. So it's there are very interesting characters that you can identify
sure.
with. They're almost as though central casting sent them. And they're really good storytellers, and you can see in their telling of the story from their vantage point why they did what they did in the 60s and why they're talking about it in the way that they describe, in this case, in the 80s.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to us about this excellent series, which I believe is available on some streaming services.
So people should
go check it out.
Thank you very much, and we hope to screen it at the Institute next year. We're thinking about having a screening all day, perhaps on King Day, the whole 14 hours.
Wow, that'd be amazing.
A marathon screening
yeah.
of Eyes on the Prize.
Keep an eye out for that.
So, Andrea, one of my favorite things about this podcast is it introduces me to so many things that I need to read or watch or listen to. And up until this week, I'm sorry to say, I wasn't familiar with Howard Thurman. But clearly, he is a man of great influence. Obviously, he influenced you. That's why we're sitting here. But you're in good company with people like Martin Luther King Jr. as well. So tell me about how you came to this material to begin with.
So I'm glad that I was able to introduce you to Howard Thurman. He's really a man for all seasons mm-hmm. and all time. He was born African American, born in Florida in 1900. and lived 81 years. And I encountered him. He was a mystic and a theologian, a philosopher, a teacher, an educator, and a humanitarian. And I came to know of Howard Thurman when I was a co-ed all the way back in the 1960s at Boston University. And Howard Thurman had been named the first dean of chapel at Boston University's Marsh Chapel. He was the first African-American to serve in such a role at a major university. And he was on the campus leading programs every Sunday morning and teaching in the School of Theology there. And had, by the time he got to BU in the 60s, was already very much into his career and was a well-known writer and thinker and philosopher. I had the good sense to get up on a Sunday morning early and find my way to Marsh Chapel and listen to his sermons, which were just extraordinary. And I really am so glad that by whatever means I discovered him, and then I had, as I say, I had the opportunity to hear him and to get to know his work. The other connection that I have, the contemporary connection that I have with Howard Thurman, in a very serendipitous way, I am currently fortunate enough to serve as a member of the Board of Trustees of my alma mater, and the alma mater of Martin Luther King, and where Howard Thurman was Dean of Chapel. So as a trustee, I'm really delighted that we are now engaged in a process of developing the Howard Thurman Center on the BU campus to be a place where people with different views and different perspectives can come together and promote the development of community and inclusion and diversity. And I think it's really, it's a wonderful kind of full circle experience for me to know that I'm among probably few of the trustees who were at BU when Howard Thurman was Dean of Chapel, and now and I had the good sense, as I said earlier, to actually go to the chapel and hear his wisdom, and to see now a center that will be developed to devote itself to his principles and to helping the next generations to embrace and understand his reflections is really a very exciting opportunity for me. So life has, you know, you never know how things will go full circle, and here I am at BU and continuing to try to learn and understand from Howard Thurman. One of the things that distinguished him at Boston University is that he did indeed mentor Dr. Martin Luther King, who was one of Boston University's most illustrious graduates and alumni, and he did his PhD work at BU in the School of Theology. And Howard Thurman is really seen and known as someone who mentored him in very, very important ways. Howard Thurman had traveled the world. He had a really strong belief in humanitarian approaches and in a global, inclusive, compassionate perspective. At a time in the world when that was not necessarily the predominant mode, and he also had an opportunity with his wife Sue Thurman to travel in the 1930s with a delegation and meet, for example, and talk with people like Tagore and Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. He really sort of brought the Gandhian approach and influence around nonviolence to the U.S. and to the civil rights movement. And he, if you read his work, and this is not my observation alone, if you read his work and understand his philosophy, you can see clearly, if you also read and try to understand Dr. King's work, that he had a major influence on Dr. King. And in much of his writing, he talks about dreams and dreamlike thinking and how in a dream you can conjure up that which you can imagine, but which may not be the reality in the real world. But if you can dream it and you can conceive of it, then you might be able to manifest it through leadership and guidance and direction. So that this dream theory and this dream, this idea of dream shows up in page after page of his writing, the Thurman's writing, and then of course we know about Dr. King and I Have a Dream and that whole notion that really gave a vision to an entire nation, really, about what this potential for an American experience, for the American democracy could be, that he's, you know, so eloquently described in 1963 at the March on Washington. And we still talk about realizing and achieving the dream in the 21st century.
That is one of, if not the most iconic speeches of our country's history. And it's so fascinating to hear background and influence on how that came to be. And you mentioned Thurman's travels and the idea of nonviolence, but also his faith was a important factor in that. I believe I read in his meeting with Gandhi, I think, that Gandhi challenged him to think through, you know, the Christian faith as a tool of moving forward,
of seeking.
Yes, and I thought that was beautiful to see that idea across nations, across faith, and the way that it came to influence our country.
Well, and it still, again, has relevance. We are a nation of such tremendous diversity, and yet we don't always reflect that in our policies, in our practices, in the way we treat each other, the way we interact with each other and come together. And so we still need to focus on that and promote that as a positive construct and not as something that divides us and compartmentalizes us. If we're going to all survive on planet Earth and thrive, and it's I think there's a phrase I think that Howard Thurman is known for, that, you know, in we should be able to allow me to be me without diminishing you being you. And so there's that's a paraphrase, but this notion that we can coexist with our differences and still, in a broader sense, we can be compatible, and we can get along. We can work together and share this planet without having a one-dimensional approach to life and to philosophy. So that's still an important lesson.
Absolutely.
In this century that Howard Thurman can bring to us. And I'm always amazed when I worship in different cities and in different settings, and surprisingly, I'll hear someone in the pulpit refer to Howard Thurman, and I'm always just delighted and surprised that, you know, he continues to endure. His message is universal and timeless.
35 years after his death, it is every bit as relevant. How does faith inform your work?
Well, I have been a member of the Baptist Church since I was a child, and my family are mostly from the Baptist faith. My grandfather, who was a child of, you know, slaves, said that if you're black and not Baptist, you've been tampered with. I'm sure there are people who might argue that point, but that's where I began. Mm-hmm. But as I matured as an adult and had free will, so to speak, to worship in whatever way I saw fit, I've come to really think that God has 99 names, which is a book titled by Judith Miller, a former New York Times writer. But I believe that. I think that spirituality and the belief in faith and faith-based activities comes in many forms, in many ways, for many different people. So one is not better than the other. It's just a matter of where you want to put your emphasis and your energy moving forward. So for me, faith is a way of thinking about guiding principles of inclusion and fairness and love and tolerance. And these are all values that run throughout almost every faith has at its core those kinds of, right. of values. And so I think it's important to understand that, to keep focusing on those values and aspiring in daily life to reflect those values in the way that we live. And we see, sadly, in contemporary life, that those values often clash more than they are compatible. And we have a lot of work to do as a community, as a nation, as a planet,
Absolutely.
To find ways to live in community in ways that don't encroach on or endanger people because of their faith and their beliefs and their practices.
Right. I mean, I firmly believe that our differences matter because they make us who we are, but we are all more alike than we are different. And when we focus on those differences, sometimes we react in fear, and that can create hatred. And we are all human.
We are all human, and we share a very fragile universe that needs to be both protected and revered. And the more we can use and draw upon our faith-based values, our positive and constructive faith-based values, to be more tolerant, to be more inclusive, to be more understanding, without being homogenized, is really, it's a challenge, I think, that probably will continue as long as there is humankind.
Yes. And there's a passage that you wanted to read from For the Inward Journey.
Yes. Well, this is a book that you can see is pretty well worn, because as I travel the world and, continue to live my life and do the work, I find it very inspirational, and so I carry it with me often and read various pieces. I will read just one piece, since we're in the fall season. There's a piece here called Fall, and I'll just read some excerpts of it. The Fall of the Year. For many of us, the fall of the year is a time of sadness and the long memory. All around us, there are the evidences of fading, of withdrawal, of things coming to an end. What was alive and growing only a few short days or weeks ago seems now to have fulfilled itself and fallen back into the shadows. Vegetation withers, but there is no agony of departure. There seems to be only death and stillness in the fall. But the fall of the year is more than all this, much, much more. It marks an important change in the cycle of the year. This change means that summer is past, one season ends by blending into another. Here is a change of pace, accenting a rhythm in the passing of time. How important this is. The particular mood inspires recollection and reflection. There is something very steadying and secure in the awareness that there is an underlying dependability in life, that change is a part of the experience of living. It is a reminder of the meaning of pause and plateau. Howard Thurman, Fall, from For the Inward Journey.
Well, Andrea, you have selected, I think, the first piece of classical music for our podcast so far. We've talked about jazz, we've talked about rap, we've talked about country, we've talked about rock, and I'm afraid that I'm ill-equipped to discuss classical music. I love listening to it as I'm falling asleep or as I'm reading, or especially when I'm writing, but I tend to be able to discuss things that are lyrical. So tell me why Maurice Ravel's Bolero, which was composed over 100 years ago, still resonates with you now.
Thank you very much, John. This was not intended to be a trick question or something that would put you at a disadvantage. And so I just want to make that clear. But as I thought about it, I wanted to bring another dimension of my cultural training and literary and musical background into the conversation. And I thought immediately of Ravel's Bolero, because it's a piece that we listen to very, very often, a lot actually, when I was growing up as a child. And I had really, I came by this quite honestly because my parents were both artists. My mother was a visual artist and an art educator, and my father actually was a musician. And he evolved into jazz, and so we could talk about jazz at another time, but he actually did his training in music as an undergraduate at West Virginia State College, now a university. And then he went on from West Virginia State to Boston University, okay, which we talked about a moment ago around Howard Thurman. But he is also a graduate of Boston University School of Fine Arts with a master's in violin that he earned in 1952. Now, you're probably asking yourself, what would an African-American male in 1952 do with a master's in violin?
What an African-American male do with
not,
a master's
not
in violin?
Not a lot in terms of feeding his family. So this was he was passionate about his music and about his music education, but he couldn't really support his family doing that, and there weren't really very many opportunities for African-American males to have positions in orchestras across the country at that time. But that was his training and his background, and so we actually listened to a lot of classical music in our home when I was growing up, recordings and tapes and other things, and I really enjoyed it. I developed an interest in it and some understanding. Don't quiz me on that, but I had, developed an awareness and an understanding and an interest in classical music studies based on my father's interest. And he himself also played a lot of jazz. So if you like music in one form, generally you're attracted to music in other forms that you know. We had very eclectic music tastes in our home, and that continues actually for me today because I have the privilege of being an advocate for classical music as well as news and information as a part of the public radio family. So I'm on the board of the New York Public Radio,
oh, wow,
which also has classical music as part of its programming. And so it's an interest that I developed early, and it continues to be important to me. And music can be so inspiring to people, whether it's jazz or classical or rock or rap, whatever it is. It's usually a connection. It forms a very positive and powerful human connection with people to talk about their experience, to, again, reflect on their experience, and to give a lift. Just think what the world would be like without music. And a piece like Ravel's Bolero is really, it's triumphant, it's majestic, it's inspiring, it makes you want to go out and, you know, tackle the world and its issues, and you feel that you can be a conqueror. You're empowered by the sounds and the tonality and the different instruments that you hear, which does include strings, so there are violins and cellos and violas and so on. So for me, classical music, and specifically this piece, just came to mind because I listened to so much of that music as a child and continue to enjoy orchestral and symphonic music.
So you play an instrument?
I do not play an instrument. My father was his musical training began at a very early age. So he was one of four children. His mother was an educator. She was a teacher. And she wanted all of her four children to play an instrument. So she insisted that they have training and practice and really be engaged from about 4 years old. And she was very clever, actually. They were growing up in West Virginia, and she wanted them to have the best musical training possible, but she was not in a position to afford private lessons for each and every one of the four. So she found the best teacher in the community in Charleston, with the most training and the most, you know, capability, and she struck a deal with this man that he would take all four of her children for one lesson at, you know, the same time, simultaneously. Yeah. The four children would be in the lesson, and she would pay for one lesson and promise that they would be prepared when they came for their lesson. And so that's how they all learned to play the piano.
Wow.
So of her four children, two of them earned a living with their music. Hmm. And one of them was my father, who didn't play in the orchestra, but he had his own jazz combo. And he had a full-time day job, but he had a full schedule of gigs and performances and activities in the music scene for his entire adult life. And his brother, his younger brother, who is still alive, currently is playing in the south of France, where
really?
He has wow. been since the 1950s when he got his degree
okay.
from Boston University in music. And so, and the other two siblings both played for their church their church organists. They played in the church community, and could have been professional musicians, but mm-hmm. pursued mm-hmm. other careers. So she actually got four really well-trained, professional-level musicians out of this one lesson for all four of her children.
That's quite a teacher.
But my father, on the other hand, took the view that that was such a demanding experience. She insisted that they practice and that they become more than proficient, that he decided he failed to impose that same discipline and expectation mm-hmm. on his children. So
right.
none of us in my generation have the same capacity. You know, I had a piano at one point in time, and I can play sort of, you know, Christmas music mm-hmm. and children's songs, happy birthday, that
yep.
kind of thing. But I never really developed the level of skill and proficiency that I wish my father had insisted, because starting early and often and really making it a discipline probably pays off.
To close, you talked about Bolero being somewhat omnipresent in your household and other classical music being omnipresent in your household growing up. Do you have any specific memories that come to mind when you hear the music today?
Well, again, it's like time travel, listening to music that any music, whether it's Bolero or anything else. When you think about the music of your life and how music is background, really, when you hear certain songs that might have been popular when you were in college or when you were, you know, raising your family or when you were dating in high school, music is a way of marking time and organizing time. So when I thought about this and reflected on your question about my favorite music, it took me right back to those early days in the 50s with my family, and it conjured up memories of even the high fidelity system that mm-hmm. was in our home.
Yeah.
It was a great big box, almost as large as this table, that had the record, you know, turntable
yeah.
and just the setting, it brought back the room, what the room looked like and the furnishing. I mean, music really does help you to map time and place. And so it was a very pleasant memory to think about the exposure that my family's background and training provided for me, that helped me in, you know, all these years later, 50-some years later, to still be appreciative of and interested in classical music and many other kinds of music. So it just made me even more committed to continuing to expose other people and provide avenues for exposure to all kinds of music. And music is a part of life. And one should be open to all kinds of music and all kinds of musical experience. And that's what Bolero did for me and continues to represent.
Well, wonderful. I know that you guys will be hosting the Birmingham Creative Roundtable on October 27th. And then we've got the upcoming Shuttlesworth Dinner in November and the ongoing programs. If people wanted to become a member or donate to the museum, they would go to
www.bcri.org, and they can push on the donate button and become a member. If they, we have basic membership starting at $35 for an additional $20 for any membership. That also includes a subscription to the Smithsonian Magazine and access to all of the Smithsonian museums. I'm very proud of the fact that Birmingham Civil Rights Institute is a Smithsonian affiliate, mm-hmm. and so we can offer that benefit to all of our members, and we encourage them to take advantage of it. We talked a little about the National Museum of African American History and Culture earlier. That's just one of the examples of institutions that are very similar and have an opportunity for people to expand their knowledge and understanding of the world we live in now and how we got here, and really to expand the vision of what we as a people and as a nation can be going forward in the 21st century. But thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been delightful to talk with you.
I'm John Hammondry. You can find me on Twitter at John Hammondry.
I'm Matt Scalise. You can find me on social media at Matt Scalise.
I'm Carla Jean Whitley, and you can find me all over social stuff at Inkstained Life.
And y'all be sure to download us on iTunes and give us a rating. Thanks.